This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't. Written and read by Jim Collins. To say this book is by Jim Collins overstates the case. Without the significant contributions made by other people, this book would certainly not exist. At the top of the list are members of the research team. I was truly blessed to have an extraordinary group of people dedicated to the project. In aggregate, they contributed something on the order of 15,000 hours of work to the project, and the standard they set for themselves and the quality of their work set a high standard for me to try to live up to. As I struggled with writing the book, I pictured all the hard-working members of the team who had dedicated months, in some cases years, to this effort, looking over my shoulder and holding me accountable, challenging me to create a final manuscript that met their standards, worthy of their toil and their contribution. I hope this effort meets with their approval. Any failure to reach that standard rests entirely with me. I'd like to briefly list right up front the names of all the members of the research team. You will encounter them in later pages because you'll see how the team played a key role and creating the ideas in this book. The members of the research team are, in alphabetical order, Brian J. Bagley, Scott Cederberg, Anthony J. Chirikos, Jenny Cooper, Dwayne C. Duffy, Eric Hagen, Morton T. Henson, Lane Horning, Christine Jones, Scott Jones, Stephanie A. Judd, Brian C. Larson, Wijah Eve Lee, Nicholas M. Osgood, Vicky Mosur Osgood, Allison Sinclair, Peter Van Genderen, Paul Weissman, Lee Wilbanks, and Amber L. Young. At the end of this audio reading, I will pause to shine a light on all of the other people who contribute significantly to making this work successful. To all of you, mentioned here and at the end, I thank you. Preface. As I was finishing this manuscript, I went for a run up a steep, rocky trail in El Dorado Springs Canyon, just south of my home in Boulder, Colorado. I'd stopped on top at one of my favorite sitting places, with a view of the high country still covered in its winter coat of snow, when an odd question popped into my mind. How much would someone have to pay me not to publish Good to Great? It was an interesting thought experiment, given that I'd just spent the previous 5 years working on the research project and writing this book. Not that there isn't some number that might entice me to bury it, but by the time I crossed the $100 million threshold, it was time to head back down the trail. Even that much couldn't convince me to abandon the project. I'm a teacher at heart. As such, it's impossible for me to imagine not sharing what we've learned with students around the world. And it's in the spirit of learning and teaching that I bring forth this work. After months of hiding away like a hermit in what I like to call monk mode, I'd very much enjoy hearing from people about what works for them and what doesn't. I hope you'll find much of value in these recordings and will commit to applying what you learn to whatever you do. If not to your company, then to your social sector work. And if not there, at least to your own life. Jim Collins, www.jimcollins.com, Boulder, Colorado. Originally published 2001, recorded in this recording and updated 2005. Chapter 1. Good is the enemy of great. That's what makes death so hard. Unsatisfied curiosity. Beryl Markham, West with the Night. Good is the enemy of great. And that's one of the key reasons why we have so little that becomes truly great. We don't have great schools principally because we have good schools. We don't have great government principally because we have good government. Few people attain great lives in large part because it is so easy to just settle for the good life. The vast majority of companies never become great precisely because the vast majority become quite good, and therein lies much of their main problem. This became piercingly clear to me in 1996 when I was having dinner with a group of thought leaders, gathered for a discussion about organizational performance. Bill Meehan, who ran the San Francisco office of McKinsey & Company, leaned over his salad and casually confided, "You know, Jim, we love Built to Last around here. You and your co-author, Jerry Porras, did a very fine job on the research and writing. Unfortunately, it's useless." I asked him to explain. "The companies you wrote about in Built to Last were, for the most part, always great," Bill Meehan said. "They never had to turn themselves from good companies into great companies. They had parents like David Packard and George Merck who shaped the character of greatness from early on. But what about the vast majority of companies that wake up partway through life and realize, hey, we're good. We're not great." I now realize that Meehan was exaggerating for effect with his useless comment, but his essential observation was correct. Truly great companies, for the most part, have always been great. And the vast majority of good companies remain just that. Good, but not great. Indeed, Meehan's comment proved to be an invaluable gift, as it planted the seed of a question that became the basis of this entire book. Namely, can a good company become a great company, and if so, how? Can good become great? Or is the disease of just being good incurable? 5 years after that fateful dinner, in writing this manuscript, we could say, without question, that good to great does happen. And we've learned much about the underlying variables that make it happen. Inspired by Bill Meehan's challenge, my research team and I embarked on a 5-year research effort, a journey to explore the inner workings of good to great. Now, to quickly grasp the concept of the project, I want you to picture a diagram. Now, you might be driving somewhere, you might be sitting at a desk, you might be running on the treadmill, but I want you to fix this picture in your brain. I want you to picture a stock chart that is broken into two halves. On the left half, it's just going sideways, right? It's just absolutely horizontal, totally flat, waffling to the side. And then there's a punctuation point, a pivot point, and bang, after a period of time, it starts to rise and climb and climb and climb and climb and climb and climb. So the left side of the page, flat. Right side of the page, climbing, climbing, climbing at about a 45-degree angle. And I'd like you to picture a second curve, which is a curve that tracks the flat curve for the first half of the page. But then, in comparison to when the good to great curve shoots upward, the second curve continues to go sideways. In other words, we were looking at companies that showed the top pattern, good performance to great performance, in contrast to other companies that showed good performance and never made it to great performance. More precisely, we identified companies that made the leap from good results to great results and sustained those results for at least 15 years. We then compared these companies to a carefully selected control group of comparison companies that failed to make that leap, or if they did make a leap, they failed to sustain it. We then compared the good to great companies to the comparison companies to discover the essential and distinguishing factors at work. The good to great examples that made the final cut into the study attained extraordinary results during the years of their leap, averaging cumulative stock returns 6.9 times the general market in the 15 years following their transition points. To put that in perspective, GE, or General Electric, considered by many to be the best-led company in America at the end of the 20th century, outperformed the market by 2.8 times over the 15 years 1985 to 2000. Now, just throwing a bunch of numbers at you. The main point here is GE is a great company. GE beat the market 2.8 to 1 in its best 15-year period, 85 to 2000. The companies in our research, over a 15-year period after breakthrough, beat the market by over twice that amount, 6.9 times the general market. Think about it another way. Imagine you had a child in 1965 and you opened an account for their future and you invested it in the Good to Great Company Mutual Fund in 1965. You put $1,000 in that account, and you take it out in 2000. That $1,000 invested on behalf of your child in 1965, taken out in 2000, would have grown to nearly $500,000. Okay, these are remarkable numbers, but they're all the more remarkable when you consider the fact that they came from companies that previously had been so utterly unremarkable. Consider just one case, Walgreens. For over 40 years, Walgreens had bumped along as a very average company, more or less tracking the general market. Then in 1975, seemingly out of nowhere, bang, Walgreens began to climb and climb and climb, and it just kept on climbing. From December 31, 1975 to January 1, 2000, $1 invested in Walgreens beat $1 invested in technology superstar Intel by 2 times, GE by nearly 5 times, Coca-Cola by nearly 8 times, and the general stock market, including the NASDAQ stock run-up at the end of 1999, by over 15 times. Think about that. How on earth did a company with such a long history of being nothing special transform itself into an enterprise that outperformed some of the best-led organizations in the world? And why was Walgreens able to make the leap when other companies in the same industry with the same opportunities and similar resources, such as Eckerd, did not make this leap? This single case, this match pair, Walgreens versus Eckerd, captures the essence of our quest. Now let me be clear, this book is not about Walgreens per se, or any of the specific companies we studied. It is about the question, can good become great, and our search for timeless, universal answers that can be applied by any organization. Our 5-year quest yielded many insights, a number of them surprising and quite contrary to conventional wisdom, but one giant conclusion stands above the others. We believe, based on the research, that almost any organization can substantially improve its stature and performance, perhaps even become great, if it consciously applies the framework of ideas we've uncovered. Keep in mind, this book is about well-founded hope. Keep in mind, we picked companies that weren't great, that became great. They changed themselves. They changed their own destiny of mediocrity to greatness. That is a hopeful message that we took and we hope you take. This book is dedicated to teaching what we've learned. The remainder of this introductory chapter tells the story of our journey, outlines our research method, and previews the key findings. Then in chapter 2, we'll launch headlong into the findings themselves, beginning with one of the most provocative of the whole study, Level 5 Leadership. Undaunted Curiosity. People often ask, what motivates you to undertake these huge research projects? It's a good question. The answer is curiosity. There's nothing I find more exciting than picking a question that I don't know the answer to, and embarking on a quest for answers. It's deeply satisfying to climb into the boat like Lewis and Clark and head west, saying, we don't know what we'll find when we get there, but we'll be sure to let you know when we get back. We came to think of our mascot as Curious George, always wanting to look under the yellow hat just to see what's there. Here's the abbreviated story of this particular odyssey of curiosity. Phase 1, the search. With the question in hand, can good become great, I began to assemble a team of researchers. And in fact, when I use we throughout this book, I'm referring to the research team. In all, 21 people worked on the project at key points, usually in teams of 3 or 4 or 6 at a time. Our first task was to find companies that showed the good to great pattern exemplified in that chart I described for you that showed the curve going sideways that then exploded upwards. We launched a 6-month death march of financial analysis, looking for companies that showed that basic pattern. 15-year cumulative stock returns at or below the general market, punctuated by a transition point. Then cumulative returns at least 3 times the market over the next 15 years. Good results to great results. We picked 15 years because it would transcend one-hit wonders and lucky breaks. It's very hard to be lucky, just lucky, for 15 years, and would exceed the average tenure of most chief executive officers, thus helping us to separate great companies from companies that just happen to have a single great leader. We picked 3 times the market because it exceeds the performance of most widely acknowledged great companies. Let me just put this in perspective. If you had a mutual fund of the following marquee set of companies, 3M, Boeing, Coca-Cola, GE, Hewlett-Packard, Intel, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Motorola, Pepsi, Procter & Gamble, Walmart, and Walt Disney. A dollar invested in those companies over the period 1985 to 2000, a 15-year period, beat the market 2.5 to 1. We made our standard into the study 3.0 to 1. This is not a bad set to beat. From an initial universe of companies that appeared on the Fortune 500 in the years 1965 to 1995, we systematically searched and sifted, eventually finding 11 good to great examples. A couple of key points deserve brief mention here. First, a company had to demonstrate the good to great pattern independent of its industry. If the whole industry showed the same pattern, if the whole industry had a leap upward off of a good base, we dropped the company. The reason is simple. We wanted companies that changed themselves rather than those that simply rode a good industry trend. Second, we debated whether we should use additional selection criteria beyond cumulative stock returns. Well, say such things as impact on society or employee welfare or corporate responsibility. We eventually decided not to do that. We eventually decided to limit our selection to the good to great results pattern, as we could not conceive of any legitimate and consistent method for selecting on these other variables without introducing our own biases. In the last chapter, I will, however, discuss the relationship between corporate values and enduring great companies. But the focus of this particular research effort is on the very specific question: how to turn a good organization into one that produces sustained, great results. At first glance, we were surprised by this list. Who would have thought that companies like Gillette or Abbott Laboratories would beat companies like GE and Coca-Cola? Or that Walgreens could beat Intel? This surprising list, you have to admit, a doubtier group would be hard to find, taught us a key lesson right up front. It is possible to turn good into great in the most unlikely of situations. This became the first of many surprises that led us to reevaluate our thinking about corporate greatness. So here are the 11 companies, and I'm going to give you the company name, the returns that they delivered in the 15 years after their good to great transition point. Abbott Laboratories. From 1974 to 1989, they beat the market 3.98 times. Circuit City. From 1982 to 1997, they beat the market 18.5 times. Fannie Mae. From 1984 to 1999, they beat the market 7.5 times. Gillette. From 1980 to 1995, they beat the market 7.39 times. Kimberly-Clark. From 1972 to 1987, beat the market 3.4 times. Kroger. From 1973 to 1988, beat the market 4.2 times. Nucor. From 1975 to 1990, beat the market 5.2 times. Philip Morris. From 1964 to 1979, beat the market 7.1 times. Pitney Bowes. From 1973 to 1988, beat the market by 7.2 times. Walgreens. From 1975 to 1990, beat the market by 7.3 times. Wells Fargo. From 1983 to 1998, beat the market by 4 times. Phase 2. Compared to what? We next took perhaps the most important step in the entire research effort, contrasting the good to great companies to a carefully selected set of comparison companies. The crucial question in our study is not, what did the good to great companies share in common? Rather, the crucial question is, what did the good to great companies share in common that distinguished them, that separated them from the comparison companies? Think of it this way. Suppose you wanted to study what makes gold medal winners in the Olympic Games. If you only studied the gold medal winners by themselves, you'd find they all have coaches. But if you looked at athletes that made the Olympic team but failed to win a gold medal, you'd find, guess what? Yep, they also have coaches. So saying coaches separates gold medal winners out doesn't fit with the data. The key question is, what systematically distinguishes gold medal winners from those who never won a medal? We selected two sets of comparison companies. The first consisted of direct comparisons. These are companies that were in the same industry as the good to great companies, with the same opportunities and similar resources at the time of transition, but that showed no leap from good to great. So think of it this way. Earlier we talked about Abbott Laboratories having its breakthrough in 1974. In 1974, when Abbott began to climb, there's a perfect matched pair comparison, Upjohn. And at that moment in time, they're very similar companies. 15 years later, Abbott is much better. The second set of comparisons consisted of unsustained comparisons. These made a short-term shift from good to great, but then they failed to maintain the trajectory. We added these to address the question of sustainability. In all, this gave us a total study set of 28 companies, 11 good to great companies, 11 direct comparisons, and 6 unsustained comparisons. So now let me briefly read to you the entire study set. First, I'm going to give you the good to great companies in contrast to the direct comparisons. Abbott Laboratories in contrast to Upjohn. Circuit City in contrast to Silo. Fannie Mae in contrast to Great Western. Gillette in contrast to Warner Lambert. Kimberly-Clark in contrast to Scott Paper. Kroger in contrast to A&P. Nucor in contrast to Bethlehem Steel. Philip Morris in contrast to R.J. Reynolds. Pitney Bowes in contrast to Adressograph. Walgreens to Eckerd. And finally, Wells Fargo to Bank of America. Then the 6 unsustained comparisons stand as a separate set that we looked at as a clump. They were Burroughs, Chrysler, Harris, Hasbro, Rubbermaid, and Teledyne. Phase 3. Inside the black box. We then turned our attention to a deep analysis of each case. We collected all articles published on the 28 companies dating back 50 years or more. We systematically coded all the material into categories, such as strategy, technology, leadership, and so forth. Then we interviewed most of the good to great executives who held key positions of responsibility during the transition era. We also initiated a wide range of qualitative and quantitative analyses, looking at everything from acquisitions to executive compensation, from business strategy to corporate culture, from layoffs to leadership style, from financial ratios to management turnover. When it was all said and done, the total project consumed 10.5 people years of effort. We read and systematically coded nearly 6,000 articles, generated more than 2,000 pages of interview transcripts, and created 384 million bytes of computer data. We came to think of our research effort as akin to looking inside a black box. Each step along the way was like installing another light bulb to shed light on the inner workings of the good to great process. With data in hand, we began a series of weekly research team debates. For each of the 28 companies, members of the research team and I would systematically read all the articles, analyses, interviews, and the research coding. I'd make a presentation to the team on that specific company, drawing potential conclusions and asking questions. Then we would debate, disagree, pound on tables, raise our voices, pause, reflect, debate some more, pause and think, discuss, pound on tables, resolve, question, and debate yet again about what it all means. It is important to understand that we developed all of the concepts in this book by making empirical deductions directly from the data. We did not begin this project with a theory to test or prove. We sought to build a theory from the ground up, derived directly from the evidence. See, going back to Curious George, it's no fun to pick up the yellow hat, look underneath and go, aha, I was right all along. No, the real fun is in lifting up the yellow hat, peering underneath, and saying, "Ooh, who would have thought?" The core of our method was a systematic process of contrasting the good to great examples to the comparisons, always asking, "What's different? What's different? What's different?" We also made particular note of dogs that did not bark. In the Sherlock Holmes classic, The Adventure of Silver Blaze, Holmes identified the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime as a key clue. Turns out the dog did nothing in the nighttime. And that, according to Holmes, was the very curious incident, which led him to the conclusion that the prime suspect must have been someone who knew the dog well. In our study, what we didn't find, dogs we might have expected to bark, but didn't, turned out to be some of the best clues to the inner workings of good to great. When we stepped inside the black box and turned on the light bulbs, we were frequently just as astonished at what we did not see as what we did. For example, larger-than-life celebrity leaders who ride in from the outside. Well, these people are negatively correlated with taking a company from good to great. 10 of 11 good-to-great CEOs came from inside the company, whereas the comparison companies tried outside CEOs 6 times more often. Here's one of my favorites. We found no systematic pattern linking specific forms of executive compensation to the process of going from good to great. The idea that the structure of executive compensation is a key driver in corporate performance, I'm sorry, it's simply not supported by the data. Strategy per se did not separate the good to great companies from the comparison companies. By this I mean both sets of companies did have well-defined strategies. And there's no evidence that the good to great companies spent more time on long-range strategic planning than the comparison companies. Now, fast-forwarding, the good to great companies did attain deeper penetrating insight, but both sets of companies had strategic plans. The good to great companies did not focus principally on what to do to become great. They focused equally on what to not do and what to stop doing. You're going to learn later in these pages that your stop doing list is more important than your to-do list. Technology and technology-driven change has virtually nothing to do with igniting a transformation from good to great. Technology cannot ignite a transformation from good to great. It cannot ignite a transformation from good to great. It can accelerate a transformation that has already taken place, but it cannot be a fundamental spark. Mergers and acquisitions play virtually no role in igniting a transformation from good to great. We did not find a single case in corporate history of a company making itself great principally through a giant merger or acquisition. Two big mediocrities joined together never make one great company. Here's one that really surprised me. The good to great companies paid scant attention to managing change, motivating people, or creating alignment. Turns out that under the right conditions, the problems of commitment, alignment, motivation, and change largely melt away. These companies had incredibly motivated employees, yet they spent almost no time motivating employees. We'll get to that. The good to great companies had no name, no tagline, no launch event, no program to signify their transformations. And think about this. Some reported being unaware of the magnitude of the transformation at the time. Later in a chapter, you're going to hear a quote from an executive that said, "We were going through a period of total transformation, but we were unaware of it at the time." It's amazing when you think about it. Only later, in retrospect, did it become clear. Yes, they did produce truly revolutionary leaps in results, but they did not do it by revolutionary process. Never confuse the two sides of the coin. Revolutionary process does not equal revolutionary results. You get revolutionary results by an evolutionary process. The good to great companies were not, by and large, in great industries, and some were in terrible industries. In no case do we have a company that just happened to be sitting on the nose cone of a rocket when it took off. Greatness is not a function of circumstance. Greatness, it turns out, is largely a matter of conscious choice. Phase 4, chaos to concept. I've tried to come up with a simple way to convey what was required to go from all the data, analyses, debates, and dogs that did not bark to the final findings in this book. The best answer I can give is that it was an iterative process of looping back and forth, developing ideas and testing them against the data, revising the ideas, building a framework, seeing it break under the weight of evidence, and then rebuilding the framework yet again. The process was repeated over and over until everything hung together in a coherent framework of concepts. We all have a strength or two in life, and I suppose mine is the ability to take a lump of unorganized information, to see patterns, and to extract order from the mess, or what members of the research team call going from chaos to concept. That said, however, I wish to underscore again that the concepts in the final framework are not my opinions. While I cannot extract my own psychology and biases entirely from the research, each finding in the final framework met a rigorous standard before the research team would deem it significant. Every primary concept in the final framework showed up as a change variable in 100% of the good to great companies and in less than 30% of the comparison companies during the pivotal years. Any insight, any idea, no matter how much I personally might like that idea, that failed this rigorous test did not make it into the book as a chapter-level concept. There were lots of neat ideas that never made it off the cutting room floor. As I'm sitting here recording this reading now over 5 years after we completed the research, I just find myself excited all over again about what fun it was to be climbing inside the black box and making sense of the dogs that did not bark and having this wonderful group of researchers who would push back and argue and debate. We came to call ourselves the Chimps in honor of our mascot, Curious George. And to be a chimp, you had to be smart and curious and willing to death march and genetically encoded to be irreverent. And having 21 unruly, smart, death marching chimps all battling with me to try to get the right answer. Oh boy, I can tell you, it was one of the funnest times of my life. Here then is an overview of the framework of concepts and a preview of what's to come in the rest of the book. Now I'd like you to think of the transformation as a process of build-up followed by breakthrough, broken into three broad stages. Stage 1, disciplined people. Stage 2, disciplined thought. Stage 3, disciplined action. Now ingrain that in your brain. Disciplined people, disciplined thought, disciplined action. Now within each of these three stages, there are sub-concepts, which are really the chapters of this book. Wrapping around the entire framework is a concept that we came to call the flywheel, which captures the gestalt of the entire process of going from good to great. The flywheel is that idea when I said earlier, you get revolutionary results by an evolutionary process. What I really mean to say is you build great momentum in the flywheel by pushing on it turn upon turn. So let me briefly comment on each of the concepts you're going to hear in the rest of the book. Level 5 leadership. We were surprised, shocked really, to discover the type of leadership required for turning good into great. Compared to high-profile leaders with big personalities who make headlines and become celebrities, well, the good-to-great leaders seem to have come from Mars. They were often self-effacing, quiet, reserved, even shy. These leaders turned out to be a paradoxical blend of personal humility and professional will. They're more like Lincoln and Socrates than Patton or Caesar. First who, then what? We expected that the good to great leaders would begin by setting a new vision and strategy. Well, we found something quite different. We found instead that they first got the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and the right people in the right seats. And then they figured out where to drive it. The old adage, people are your most important asset. Well, that turns out to be wrong. If you're making something great, people are not your most important asset. The right people are. Confront the brutal facts, yet never lose faith. We learned that a former prisoner of war had more to teach us about what it takes to find a path to greatness than most books on corporate strategy. Every good to great company embraced what we came to call the Stockdale Paradox in honor of Admiral Jim Stockdale. You must retain unwavering faith that you can and will prevail in the end, regardless of the difficulties. And at the same time, have the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. The hedgehog concept, or simplicity within the three circles. To go from good to great requires transcending the curse of competence. Just because something is your core business, just because you've been doing it for years or perhaps even decades, does not necessarily mean you can be the best in the world at it. And if you can't be the best in the world at your core business, then I'm sorry, your core business absolutely cannot form the basis of a great company. It must be replaced with a simple concept that reflects a deep understanding of three intersecting circles. A culture of discipline. All companies have a culture. Some companies have discipline. But few have a culture of discipline. When you have disciplined people, you don't need hierarchy. When you have disciplined thought, you don't need bureaucracy. When you have disciplined action, you don't need excessive controls. When you combine a culture of discipline with an ethic of entrepreneurship, you get the magical alchemy of great performance. Technology accelerators. Good to great companies think differently about the role of technology. They never use technology as the primary means of igniting a transformation. Yet, paradoxically, they are pioneers in the application of carefully selected technologies. We learned that technology by itself is never a primary root cause of either greatness or decline. The flywheel and the doom loop. Those who launch revolutions, dramatic change programs, and wrenching restructurings will almost certainly fail to make the leap from good to great. No matter how dramatic the end result, the good to great transformations never happened in one fell swoop. There was no single defining action, no grand program, no one killer innovation, no solitary lucky break, no miracle moment. Rather, the process resembled relentlessly pushing that giant heavy flywheel in one direction, turn upon turn, building momentum until the point of breakthrough and beyond. So now I want you to keep in mind disciplined people, disciplined thought, disciplined action. And I've gone through the key concepts that fall in those stages. The concepts that I briefly reviewed in the previous few minutes are really the results of the Good to Great Research Project, and they fall into the categories of disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought, who take disciplined action. But there is a fourth stage, which is building greatness to last. In an ironic twist, I now see Good to Great not as a sequel to Built to Last, but as actually the prequel. Good to Great is about how to turn a good organization into one that produces sustained great results. Built to Last is about how you take a company with great results and turn it into an enduring great company of iconic stature. To make that final shift requires core values and a purpose beyond just making money, combined with the key dynamic of preserve the core, stimulate progress. So think of it this way. You take the good to great principles to get great results. Then you add the built to last principles to go to an enduring great company. If you're already a student of Built to Last, please set aside your questions about the precise links between the two studies as you embark upon the findings here in Good to Great. In the last chapter, I will return to this question and link the two studies together. The Timeless Physics of Good to Great. I just finished presenting my research to a set of internet executives in the late 1990s gathered at a conference when a hand shot up from the back of the room. The young man attached to the hand glared at me and said, Will your findings continue to apply in the new economy? Don't we need to throw out all the old ideas and start from scratch? It's a legitimate question, as we do live in a time of dramatic change. And it comes up so often that I'd like to dispense of it right up front, before heading into the meat of the book. Yes, the world is changing, and it's going to continue to change. But that does not mean we should stop the search for timeless principles. Think of it this way. While the practices of engineering continually evolve and change, the laws of physics remain relatively fixed. I like to think of our work as a search for timeless principles, the enduring physics of great organizations that will remain true and relevant no matter how the world changes around us. Yes, the specific application will change, the engineering, if you will. But certain immutable laws of organized human performance, the physics, will endure. The truth is, there's nothing new about being in a new economy. Every economy is a new economy. Those who faced the invention of electricity, the telephone, the automobile, the radio, or the transistor, did they feel it was any less of a new economy than we feel today? Of course not. And in each rendition of the new economy, the best leaders have adhered to certain basic principles with rigor and discipline. Some people will say that the scale and pace of change is greater today than any time in the past. Perhaps. I doubt it, but I'll grant that perhaps that might be true. Even so, some of the companies in our Good to Great study faced rates of change that rival anything in our new economy. For example, during the early 1980s, the banking industry was completely transformed in about 3 years, as the full weight of deregulation came crashing down. It was certainly a new economy for the banking industry. Yet Wells Fargo applied every single finding in this book to produce great results right smack in the middle of the fast-paced change triggered by deregulation. As you immerse yourself in the coming chapters, keep one key point in mind. This book is not about the old economy. This book is not about the new economy. It's not even about the companies we studied, or even about business per se. It is ultimately about one thing, the timeless principles of good to great. It's about how you take a good organization and turn it into one that produces sustained great results, using whatever definition of results best applies to your organization. This might come as a bit of a surprise, but I don't primarily think of my work as about the study of business, nor do I see this as fundamentally a business book. Rather, I see my work as being about discovering what creates enduring great organizations of any type. I'm deeply curious to understand the fundamental differences between great and good, between excellent and mediocre. I just happen to use corporations as the means of getting inside the black box. I do this because publicly traded corporations, unlike other types of organizations, have two huge advantages for research. A widely agreed upon definition of results, so we can rigorously select a study set, and a plethora of easily accessible data. I do not believe that pure science is possible in the social sector, because science requires two fundamental criteria. One of them is replicability. The second is predictability. Now, I don't believe we can have predictability. I do not believe that you predict in the social sector everything that's going to happen in the future, because you can't do controlled experiments the way you can in, say, physics or chemistry. However, one thing I'm deeply proud about in our research is that we have the first leg of good science. And that is replicability. Somebody should be able to take the appendix, the research appendix in Good to Great, without knowing who the companies are, and they should be able to follow the precise research methodology we laid out, get the companies, replicate the research, and validate our findings. This piece of science is strong, and I feel very proud that our data-driven approach can give us reasonable confidence in our findings. That good is the enemy of great is not a business problem. It's a human problem. If we have cracked the code on the question of good to great, we should have something of value to any type of organization. Good schools might become great schools. Good newspapers might become great newspapers. Good churches might become great churches. Good government agencies might become great government agencies. And good companies might become great companies. So I invite you to join me on an intellectual adventure to discover what it takes to turn good into great. I also encourage you to question and challenge what you learn. As one of my favorite professors once said, "The best students are those who never quite believe their professors." True enough. But he also said, "One ought not to reject the data merely because one does not like what the data implies." I offer everything herein for your thoughtful consideration, not your blind acceptance. You're the judge and jury. Let the evidence speak. In the intervening years since writing Good to Great, I've been delightfully surprised by how the work has reached into non-business. Of the copies that have been sold, based upon my email traffic, I would estimate that something on the order of 40% of our readers are non-business readers. We have people in churches and education and healthcare and homeless centers and police departments. And I think my favorite email was from a fighter pilot who sent a email in saying they'd named their squadron of fighter jets after the hedgehog in Chapter 5. I just picture these fighter jets going up in the sky and knocking the enemy out and thinking to themselves, "You may know many maneuvers, but I know one big one, and it's a good one." But there's a serious point to this. When we wrote Good to Great, as you heard a couple of moments ago, I believed that the ideas could apply outside of business. I hoped that they would be embraced outside of business, but I wasn't certain. In the intervening years, the overwhelming support of non-business people of these ideas has been very satisfying to me. At the same time, I've also learned that there are differences in applying the ideas in the social sector than in the business sector. The principles are still the principles, but there are, of course, nuances of application. If you stay tuned to our work, you will eventually see how we address the differences between the two. In the meantime, though, step number one is to learn the fundamental principles, and it is to those principles that we now turn. Chapter 2, Level 5 Leadership. You can accomplish anything in life provided that you do not mind who gets the credit. Harry S. Truman. In 1971, a seemingly ordinary man named Darwin E. Smith became chief executive of Kimberly-Clark, a stodgy, old paper company whose stock had fallen 36% behind the general market over the previous 20 years. Smith, the company's mild-mannered in-house lawyer, wasn't so sure the board had made the right choice, a feeling further reinforced when a director pulled Smith aside and reminded him that he lacked some of the qualifications for the position. But CEO he was, and CEO he remained for 20 years. And oh, what a 20 years it was. In that period, Smith created a stunning transformation, turning Kimberly-Clark into the leading paper-based consumer products company in the world. Under his stewardship, Kimberly-Clark generated cumulative stock returns 4.1 times the general stock market, handily beating its direct rivals Scott Paper and Procter & Gamble. And not only that, outperforming such venerable companies as Coca-Cola, Hewlett-Packard, 3M, and General Electric. It was certainly an impressive performance. In fact, one of the best examples in the 20th century of taking a good company and making it great. Yet few people, even ardent students of management and corporate history, know anything about this mild-mannered, shy, reserved man named Darwin Smith. And he probably would have liked it that way. A man who carried no airs of self-importance. Smith found his favorite companionship among plumbers and electricians, and he spent his vacations rumbling around his Wisconsin farm in the cab of a backhoe, digging holes and moving rocks. He never sought to be a hero, never sought to be a celebrity. When a journalist came and said, "Darwin, please explain your management style," Smith and got to picture him. He was dressed unfashionably like a farm boy wearing his first suit bought at JCPenney. And he just stared back across the desk in his nerdy-looking black-rimmed glasses. And after a long, and I mean long, like minutes, uncomfortable silence, he said simply, "My management style? Eccentric." The Wall Street Journal did not write a splashy feature on Darwin Smith. But if you were to think of Darwin Smith as somehow meek or soft, you would be terribly mistaken. His awkward shyness, his lack of pretense, was coupled with a fierce, even stoic, resolve toward life. Smith grew up as a poor Indiana farm boy. He put himself through college by working the day shift at International Harvester and attending Indiana University at night. One day, he lost part of a finger on the job. The story goes that he went to class that evening and returned to work the next day. While that might be a bit of an exaggeration, he clearly did not let a lost finger slow down his progress toward graduation. He kept working full time, he kept going to class at night, and he earned admission to Harvard Law School. Later in life, 2 months after being named chief executive, doctors diagnosed Darwin Smith with nose and throat cancer, predicting that he had less than a year to live. He told the board about his cancer, but he made it clear that he was not yet dead, and he had no plans to die anytime soon. Battling the cancer, Smith held fully to his demanding work schedule, while at the same time commuting weekly from Wisconsin to Houston for radiation therapy. And not only that, he beat the cancer. He defeated the cancer. He wore it down. Maybe it was luck. Maybe it was good genes. Maybe it was his stoic resolve. But any way you slice it, he lived 25 more years. 20 of them as CEO. Smith brought that same ferocious resolve to rebuilding Kimberly-Clark, especially when he made the most dramatic decision in the company's history. Sell the mills. Shortly after he became CEO, Smith and his team had concluded that the traditional core business, coated paper, was doomed to mediocrity. Its economics were bad, and the competition weak. But, they reasoned, if Kimberly-Clark thrust itself into the fire of the consumer paper products industry, world-class competition like Procter & Gamble would force it to achieve greatness or perish. One night, while sitting on his back porch, he turned to his wife and said, "I learned something from fighting my own cancer. If you have a cancer in your arm, you have to have the guts to cut off your own arm. I've made a decision. We're going to sell the mills." So like the general who burned the boats upon landing, leaving only one option, we're either going to succeed here or we're going to die on this island. Smith announced the decision to sell the mills in what one board member called the gutsiest move he'd ever seen a CEO make. Sell even the mill in Kimberly, Wisconsin. This is Kimberly-Clark. Sell the mill in Kimberly, Wisconsin, and throw all the proceeds into the consumer business, investing in brands like Huggies and Kleenex. The business media called the move stupid, and the Wall Street analysts downgraded the stock. Smith never wavered. 25 years later, Kimberly-Clark owned Scott Paper outright, and it beat Procter & Gamble in 6 of 8 product categories. In retirement, Smith, who clearly could have gloated over his great success, reflected by saying simply, "I never stopped trying to become qualified for the job." Darwin Smith stands as a classic example of what we came to call the level 5 leader, an individual who blends extreme personal humility, "It is not about me," with an intense professional will. We found leaders of this type at the helm of every good to great company during the transition era. Like Smith, they were self-effacing individuals who displayed the fierce resolve to do whatever needed to be done to make the company great. Level 5 leaders channel their ego away from themselves and into a larger goal of building a great company. It's not that Level 5 leaders lack ego or self-interest. Indeed, they are incredibly ambitious, but their ambition is first and foremost for the institution, not themselves. The term level 5 refers to the highest level in a hierarchy of leadership capabilities that we found in our research. Now, wherever you are, I want you to think of the following hierarchical pyramid. Picture a pyramid that has different stages in it, and at the very base of the pyramid would be your level 1 stage. And then as you move up that pyramid, you get to level 2. And then as you go further, you get to level 3 and 4, and at the very top of the pyramid, you get level 5. To be a level 5 means that you've moved through all of these stages. Level 1, stage 1, is being a highly capable individual. This means basically you have talent and knowledge and skills and good work habits. When you move up to level 2, you become a contributing team member. And this is when you become excellent at contributing your individual talents to a group effort. Then you move to level 3, which is to be a competent manager. This is when you get excellent at organizing people and resources toward the achievement and effectiveness of predetermined objectives. A good, solid, competent manager. Level 4 is the first stage of what we call effective leadership. And level 4 leaders tend to catalyze commitment to and a vigorous pursuit of a clear and compelling vision. And they stimulate ever higher standards of performance. Now you might think that that's the top of the hierarchy. That's the top of the progression. What could be higher than being an effective leader? Turns out, there's a higher level, and that is what we found in our research. The higher level is the level 5, the level 5 executive, the level 5 leader. The level 5 leader not only has leadership skills, not only has management skills, not only has team skills, not only has individual skills. The level 5 has that extra dimension of humility and will. That extra dimension of being ambitious first and foremost for the cause, not themselves, and the will to make good on it. This is the signature of the level 5. This is the signature that few have. To use an analogy, the leadership is the answer to everything perspective is the modern equivalent of the God is the answer to everything perspective that held back our scientific understanding of the physical world in the Dark Ages. In the 1500s, people ascribed all events they didn't understand to God. Why did crops fail? God did it. Why did we have an earthquake? God did it. What holds the planets in place? God. But with the Enlightenment, we began the search for a more scientific understanding. Physics and chemistry and biology and so forth. Not that we became atheists. That's not the point here. But rather, we gained deeper understanding about how the universe works. Similarly, every time we attribute everything to leadership, we're no different from the people in the 1500s. We're simply admitting our ignorance. Not that we should become leadership atheists. Leadership does matter. But every time we throw our hands up in frustration, reverting back to, well, leadership must be the answer to everything, we prevent ourselves from gaining deeper, more scientific understanding about what makes great companies tick. In the 20th century, when it comes to social systems, our giant plug figure is leadership. And every time we don't understand a social system, we just simply say, leadership, leadership, leadership. Why did a company do well? Oh, the leadership must have been great. But then if that company ceases to do well, we say, oh, the leadership must not have been as great as we thought. And we just go round and round in a circle. It's sloppy. We don't learn anything. So I said to the team at the beginning of the study, we will not have a leadership answer in this book. But fortunately for me, I have a need to surround myself with people who really don't care what I think. They're imbued with the philosophy that they should be loyal to the data, not to me. And one day I walked into the research team meeting and the whole team was looking at me and a spokesman for the team said, Jim, today is the day that we've decided to tell you that you are wrong. You are wrong about this leadership thing. We believe that the leaders in these studies, the people like Darwin Smith, played a huge role in the company making the leap from good to great. And you can't take that out of the equation.